Welcome to the Double Loop Podcast, your source for everything about fingerprints. While you're working on your comparisons, we'll talk about comparisons. I'm Eric Ray.
And I'm Glenn Langenberg.
All right, welcome back, Glenn. We're gonna, I think, jump real quick right back into things. Again, thanks to all of our patrons on patreon.com and appreciate their contributions to help us keep doing all the things that we're doing here. And if you're interested in also participating, send in a couple bucks our way. You know, you can take a look at patreon.com/doubleloop podcast to see what that's all about.
Yes. And as you said, we're going to just jump right into the episode. We're going to skip all the intro because we're on a roll right now. And this is part two. It will not make any sense to you unless you go back and listen to part one, which is, I think, all the factual elements about the case as much as we could talk about the facts of the case. Now we're going to kind of dig in a little bit to the commission's role in this report. And then, of course, the recommendations coming out of that.
So, you know, when we left off last time, it was with your involvement in the case. Now, last time you also mentioned that you're familiar with the commission's work in other cases in Texas. So I think it sounded like it, you're impressed with what they'd done before. And, you know, when they came calling asking for assistance, you were excited to jump in and offer what help you could in your expertise.
Yes. First of all, the fact that there is a commission, right, with actual teeth to it, some powers in a way. They can make recommendations. They can say certain things. They can, in some way be an arbitrator where you can bring a complaint and say, here's what's going on. We have an issue. The fact that they have these mechanisms for these investigations is really a testimony to what Texas is doing in forensic science. I think it's fantastic. And they have been very clear in other kinds of cases, complaints, or disciplines about, here's what happened in this case. Here's why these things went wrong. We think best practices should be this. Or, yes, it was conducted under standards, from 2005, but these standards changed in 2010, and we think they should be using the new standard in 2010. So the fact that they have this mechanism, I think, is really fascinating, allows them to do a deep dive. And most importantly, like, when they were bringing me on, they told me a little bit about their history. And although, again, I'd read their other reports, this was really something very important. What they wanted me to do in the case was effectively be like an assessor, like an accreditation assessor. And that was really how I saw my role, was go into the case record, learn everything you can from the case record and explain it to us. We're not fingerprint people. Now, there is one person on the commission who understands fingerprints to a very good degree. But explain it to us. What does this mean? And then please also tell us what the standard was in the early 2000s. Tell us what the standard was in 2010 when the first exams were done. Tell us what the standard was in 2013 when the identification was made. Tell us what the standard was in 2016 when testimony occurred, and what are the standards today? And this was something that I think some of the people involved really struggled with, because they felt it was unfair that they were being judged in some way. They looked at it as being judged by today's standards. You might look at the documentation and go, well, in 2010, here's what they did, but by today's standard, you'd be expected to do this. And, the reaction was, well, that's not fair. It was 2010. We should be judged by what was in 2010. That's not how the commission operates, though. The commission wants to look at what happened back then, what existed that you could have been following, and whether or not you were or not, you could have been back then, and where are we today? Would this case have benefited in some way from having today's standards? And so it was very important for me to have a very clear record, because the only way, because you mentioned in the last episode, you worked for the contracting agency, RSNA, as a contractor. Yep. I never worked for them for that. So that was ideal for the commission, was to have someone who didn't know their procedures and processes. Someone from the outside looking at a case who understands this field. Can I understand what was done? And there were many times in the case that I hit roadblocks and went, I don't know what this is. I don't know what this documentation is, or I'm not sure who did this, or I'm not sure why this is here. And some of that came out later, like some of it needed explanation, and there were reasonable explanations for some of it. And still today, some of it I have still today have questions, as we talked about in the last episode. We just don't know. And we can guess or we can theorize what might have happened, but because the documentation isn't there, we just don't know. So that was really my role, was an assessor and an historian.
Right. That makes sense, right? Yeah. What were the standards at the time, or at least the options at the time? And, but more importantly, if there was something lacking at the time in actual practice and or the standards, you know, what direction should we take in the future? And that's really the part exactly. I'm also looking forward to getting to at the end of this episode, is the recommendations for the future.
Right. Now, one of the big controversies in the case was, what was Glenn's opinion? And from the early discussions with the commission, I said to them, I don't know it's really necessary for me to give an opinion here about source. And the commission seemed very clear with that. Like, we don't really care about that per se. I mean, I guess if it's obvious and straightforward and that kind of thing, sure, but would there really be these issues if it was so clear and obvious? And so their feeling was, no, we want you to tell us what happened in the case, maybe why it happened, if you can tell, why this, why that, and again, what standards were in place at the time and currently in place, and what research has been done that we can use to talk about what should be done in the future. So the ultimate conclusion was not something that they were asking for, and I wasn't providing. So to date, I've actually not told the commission, or anyone actually, even you, Eric, I've not said what my conclusion would have been in this case. Now, I did conduct an ACE. I didn't do a V. I did an ACE. I did an analysis, which is documented in the report, because I felt that was pretty important, because it showed some really important aspects of the print in question, L1. So my analysis is part of that record, but I never gave them my comparison or evaluation data.
All right, let me clarify something here real quick. So to be clear, in the report is your analysis step. You've done ACE, including reaching a conclusion, but that's not part of the C and E steps are not in the report. You've not released or told anyone what your opinion on those two phases of ACE are.
Yeah, that would be correct. But to add a little more to that, there are some things to be very, very clear, because I do want to be transparent here. There were some things I did tell the commission. So I guess one could argue, right, that I discussed my comparison, the evaluation. I think part of that's in the report. So here is what I have said. There are corresponding features in L1 to the left palm of Webster. So there is correspondence. There are matching characteristics, mm-hmm. right? So that's, if you will, part of my comparison. There are matching characteristics. Second thing I said is, a conclusion that's not on the table is Webster cannot be excluded. Because he has matching characteristics, he can't be excluded. So
Seems pretty obvious, yeah.
Right. So that's a conclusion not on the table, which really comes down to, now, sufficiency. If you've got matching characteristics, do you have enough to support your identification? And if not enough for an ID, can you offer a qualified conclusion, like strong support or moderate support for same source? Or if you prefer, which I don't prefer, inconclusive with some similarities.
Right.
So that's really what it comes down to, is do you have the data to support your conclusion of an identification or something less than that, qualified? And so here's what I've said over and over and over, and will continue to say, my opinion is your conclusion, whether it's ID or a qualified conclusion, will be based on three things: which images you relied upon, which data you relied upon, like which features you used in your examination, and which methods you are using for your ACE-V methodology. Those three things are critical. Because there were multiple photographs that showed, as you pointed out in the previous episode, showed different areas zoomed in on the palm print, on the post. It was on a curved surface. It was in and out of focus. So there are various parts of the post that are in and out of focus. Some photographs show the upper portion better than the lower portion, or maybe yep. in or out of focus, different lighting. There's all these different shots. And to truly have an understanding of this mark at the scene, you really want to use as many photographs as possible. And I ended up using like 4 or 5 in my analysis. And I found that using multiple ones, including the DEA ones, there was some discussion, you know, in the last episode about the digital quality of the DEA photographs being lower pixels per inch. But I don't think they should be dismissed because they actually also show additional information you can't find in the negatives because of enhancements that they were doing. They were doing some basic enhancement at the time. And so to me, it's all the images that really matter. And we did see that when some examiners focused on some images over other images, not knowing you better look at all of them, then we did see that they were reaching different conclusions. That was some of the variability in the process. For example, we talked about Henry and Carrie and the HFSC. They didn't get the negatives. They didn't get the high quality images. They got just the DEA photos, which were lower resolution photos. They didn't get all these other photographs. And they got a photocopy, like a scanned digital photocopy of the palm print in the case. So they didn't even get a good high-res scan of the palm print. And you can clearly see where the scanning process or photocopy process dropped out information in the palm. So not only did they have substandard palms to compare against, they didn't have a complete set of photographs. And the photographs that they had to rely on were very limited, where I think there are other photographs I would have preferred to have had over the DEA photographs. So the images definitely matter. That is why Henry's group reached inconclusives from the get-go, because they had poor quality images. That's very clear. It's very understandable. That's what happened. Now, why did they just have those images? Well, that's what the defense attorney gave them. They reached out to the defense attorney and was like, hey, we need images. Defense reached out to the prosecutor and said, give us your images. And that's all the prosecutor had. That's what was in the case file. And so they get this disc and they give it back to Henry. And so defense gives this disc. And nobody knows that there's any other images available because there is no file. It's all stored away. And that's where all these other images and markups are in the file. They don't have any of that. They only have these 7 images from a disc.
I'm just curious about your opinion on this. So Henry obviously got it from defense. Defense gets it from prosecution. Mm-hmm. Is that where the responsibility lies? If defense requests, here, I need all the latent print evidence from this case, and my expert's saying, give me this quality, all this stuff, and defense is given from prosecution, who knows if this was said, but presumably prosecution saying, all right, this is everything.
That's what they said.
Prosecution's responsibility to ensure that that is complete? Is it defense's responsibility to push back and say, find better? The expert's responsibility to push on defense, to push on prosecution? You know, is it a shared responsibility from all parties? Where does that responsibility lie?
According to Ron at his talk last year, that responsibility lies with Henry Swofford. Because he was the private consultant, he should have known better and done a better job to get those images. And that was something fundamentally I didn't think was very fair, because I have been in this position many times. And if you ask the attorneys, hey, give me all the images, and they're telling you that's all that's there, how could you possibly know there's anything else? Now, that's all I'm going to say, because that's what Ron said publicly. And I'm just going to leave it at that. I don't agree with that. I don't know whose responsibility it is, but I can understand what happened.
Yeah.
I will say this, though. Yeah. If there had been documentation in the case file from 2016 during that testimony, there could have been images in the case file that, if you got the case file, you'd go, wait a sec, hold on. These images aren't the ones I had. There must be other images. If those images had been part of the case record and available in the 2016 trial and turned over, and all that was there, this would have been avoided altogether. And that wasn't done.
Just a year ago, we talked about the Cowens case up in Boston, where there's quite a bit of documentation because of the court record, right? Because of the charted enlargement that made it into the court record as evidence. And that really helped demonstrate what kind of happened in this case and some of the things that went wrong in that case.
Yeah.
If it was all just no report, no court chart, no nothing, then boy, who knows about that one?
Yeah. So where there's a little bit of finger pointing about whose responsibility, again, the commission stayed out of that. I mean, I have my opinion because I'm a proponent of documentation. And I think it's important, even though, you know, there might not be a study that says, well, you need the document. It's examples like this that say, boy, if we had had that, this all could have been avoided.
I mean, it's not, I don't think it's a study that's needed. It's the
Some are asking for the studies before they die. Anyway, yeah.
It's not the point. The point is this is the court system that we work in. And, you know, the court system just relies on documentation, right? You know, there's no study that shows you have to show the chain of custody to have an accurate result when you go into court. That's a requirement of the court. And so we have to live by the requirements of the court.
Yeah. So, all right. So that's number one. The images mattered, definitely mattered. And not having access to all the images or you do have access to all the images, but only select certain images.
All right. So we talk about the images. The images matter. Which images you get and compare matters. What about the data?
One of the things that I did, and this is near and dear to my heart because this is what I studied throughout my thesis. I've studied this for over 20 years. It's the concept of when people mark up characteristics, are they even consistent with themselves? I mean, I've studied, and we've talked about other studies in the past, if you have 10 examiners and give them all the same images, do they mark them up the same? No, they definitely don't. There will be a lot of variability and noise in which features they mark up. There'll be some characteristics they all agree on, or there's a consensus, and then there'll be plenty of characteristics they only mark once or twice, or no one else marks, but only one examiner marks. And so, even more interestingly, because that's called reproducibility, the same thing given to multiple people, what if you get the same latent print to the same examiner at different times? Will that same examiner mark it up exactly the same way? And we know from, again, my thesis, research, and other studies, the answer is no. Even the same examiner will not mark it up the same way. That on different days, different times, they might see the information a little differently. So what I did was I took the four or five, what I thought, best images, and I marked them all up like on day one. And I came back a day or two later and marked them up again, and I think like one or two of them, I even marked up a third time. So I marked them up multiple times over multiple days. And there was definitely a set of features that were in agreement across all the images. But it was amazing to see how, well, this image, I didn't mark anything in that area. But in this image, I did mark things in that area. And then on this day, I marked some of those and didn't mark some of these. Like, this is a natural known phenomenon. Again, this kind of came up a little bit in the background where the people involved didn't seem to really understand that. They're like, well, why would you mark different things on different times? This isn't because I'm a bad examiner or I'm like a flawed examiner. This is a human thing. We know this from research. This is not new. This is not compelling. It's because it's a complex mark. And because an examiner looking at it might interpret it at different times in different ways, that says something about the information in there. That certain signals, certain features are very reliable, reproducible, and repeatable. And certain features are not. And that's all the report is trying to show is that look at Glenn's markings. Notice how they vary depending on which images he's using, which times he's marking them. And notice that they vary quite a bit. Sometimes he's got more. Sometimes he's got less. Sometimes they're marked green using gyro. Sometimes they're marked yellow. There's significant variability. So which features you ultimately end up going with, like a consensus feature set or just green features or green and yellow or green, yellow, and red, it matters. It really matters. Because if you only have eight good, robust features that show up over and over and over, you only got eight good features. On the other hand, if you got 17, 18, 19, or 20 features, well, that's a lot more data to work with. And a lot more ridges and a lot more ridge characteristics. So it really depends on ultimately which data you say, this is what I'm going to rely on.
It's funny you say, you know, known phenomenon with human examiners. I mean, actually, it goes beyond that to even the non-human part, right? You hit the autoencode on a latent, and any slight variation on where you place the box to select where the latent is and rotate it even a degree off is going to change which features are detected by that autoencoder, where they're placed, and even which algorithm you use, depending on, again, which APHIS you have, the autoencoder for fingers and palms are different. So if you select, hey, this latent is a palm, and hit autoencode, and then you say, oh, never mind, it's a finger, and then you autoencode again, you get a different set of features marked out.
Yeah, that's a fantastic point. Yes, absolutely. And nothing new in our discipline or other fields. Like in DNA, same thing happens. You give a very complex profile and have examiners like decide which peaks are true or, you know, which ones are artifacts. You'll get variability as well. And even the same examiner might have variability. This is not like a specific latent print thing. It's a human interpretation thing.
And it's not pointing to, oh, this latent is garbage. Now you can't do anything or reach any conclusion.
Right.
Not at all. It's pointing to the complexity of the examination that's underway. And, yes, you know, potentially the need for increased documentation, increased, you know, number of verifiers, just increased quality control overall, because there is an increased risk of error with a complex print.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
I'm sure that everyone can agree with that, right? The messier the print is, the more likely someone is to make a mistake on it. And this is one way to tell that it's going to be messy, is because as you mark it out multiple times, you find yourself not placing the features in the exact same spot every time.
Right.
Okay. So the third one is the method, right? So you said, which method do you use? So, I mean, there's ACV, right? What do you mean when you say different methods?
Yes. And I'm very glad you asked this, because to be very clear, there are different ways that you can apply ACV. A very good example would be linear process. So I used a linear process. In other words, it was critical to me when I'm marking the unknown L1, the mark from the crime scene, I'm not doing it looking at the known impression. Mm. And if you're looking at the known impression, or you believe that there's no harm in using the known impression to mark up L1, you're going to have completely different features marked. And one of the things we tended to notice, like in the markings, was didn't seem like anyone had marked up the impression first before comparing the latent to the known. And all the markups were done side by side using the known impression. They were there, except for one set of markings, well, technically two, but one that had like a number of features marked, one had a target group, but one had a number of features marked, we don't know who marked that one up. That was, to me, the most legitimate markup of L1, because that was clearly done before the known impression. How do I know that? Because there were false minutiae marked in the impression. If you are just marking up the latent print, you will have some minutiae that you think are minutiae that are not true minutiae. You won't find them in Webster's print. So this is really important, whether or not you're doing it in this linear fashion, whether or not you allow for lots of changes or adjustments during the comparison phase, or are you doing it blind or non-blind? That was another thing that came up as part of the method was, is it more important to give this impression to lots and lots of people, but non-blind? They all are looking at the same image, but they all know the conclusions of everyone else already in the case. Or are you giving it blind? So when we look at Henry's approach, his method was to do it blinded.
I see what you mean.
I would argue that's part of your method, to blind or not blind. Another thing that Henry did was, Henry looked at all the markings of the three individuals that he gave the latent to, and then looked at which consistent features they had across their markings and said, here are consistent features. Here's seven that they all agree on. So now let's base our conclusion off of these robust features that show up in everybody's markings. And in my opinion, there are about 5 to 7 features, depending on which area you're looking at, you will consistently get everybody marking. Then it becomes a debate on, well, what other features can be used? So in signal noise theory, right, you've got certain signals that are very, very, very strong and everyone agrees, and then you've got this background noise. So can you use the background noise? Well, that's based on the examiner, their interpretation, their opinion. So what is the method that you're using? Are you using a more rigorous, structured approach and only strong signal data that's repeatable, or are you allowing examiner discretion and a little bit of flexibility and changing after looking at the known? It really matters. This is actually one of the things that's really bothering me quite a bit about this case, because we know that we have the documentation in the case. And again, multiple people identified it in the case, and they have their documentation showing the features that their decision is based on. I have no issues with that. I would love to know who did the actual analysis absent the known. We don't know who did that. There are some guesses of who might have, but we don't know. So the only thing in the case file is these people made IDs, but clearly they're using the known as well, side by side, to mark up their features. The thing that's really bothering me, and I'm very curious to hear what happens at this year's IAI, is I don't want revisionist history. We know what's in the case file, and I have a concern that people are now saying, and this happened at last year's conference, is one of the things that I think upset us a little bit, was this latent print in the case file, at best, has marked up with 15 to maybe 20 features. Like, that's probably like one of the high-end markups, 15 to 20 features, again, using the known impression, or at least it's side by side. And now it's being marked up with, what, 63 features? That's 63?
Something like that.
It's over 60 features. You cannot reliably mark over 60 features in that print. And I will go to bat on this, and I will take anyone to task on this, and I'm laying the gauntlet. You can't mark that many accurate features without using the known impression. Just, it's not going to happen. And I will lay the gauntlet on that. So my concern is that people are now saying, well, this has 60-some features. How can you not ID something with 60-some features in comparison? Yeah, that's not in the case record. No one in the case record has 60-some features. It's only in modern times, after digital enhancement, using the known. And it's bothering me in my soul because it's not representative of what happened in the case.
Right. And we have to keep coming back to that, right? That this is not just an examination taking place in a vacuum. This ties back to a case, a court case, and testimony, and the evidence put before a jury. And
yes, 60-some features were not put before a jury.
Right. And it'd be a completely different situation if there were a chart with 60-some odd features that was presented to the jury 8 years ago now. A completely different situation. But that's not there. There is no documentation at the time when the jury was hearing this testimony.
Yes.
And whether or not you can do that now isn't really the point.
Yes.
Because, sure, maybe this one is fine, and you can go ahead and do that now, right? But if that is the consistent way that you approach this work, right, where you don't show your work, you don't show your documentation, you don't show which features you used to rely, that you relied on to reach your conclusion, it's going to bite you in the ass. It's not, there's going to be a case eventually that you can't go back and find the stuff because it's, oops, not there. So that is really the point of this has to be documented and clear so that it can be reviewed and by all sides and presented fairly and that in our legal system, it meets all these requirements for evidence and both sides have a shot at looking at, you know, really the strength of that evidence. And if it's not all there, then that's a problem because you can't know ahead of time which is going to be that case where, oops, the lack of documentation was hiding a problem. So fine, maybe that's not the case here. It wasn't hiding a problem in this case potentially, but that's not the point. The point is that the documentation was lacking and making it up later doesn't fix it.
I think the other issue that bothers me is that this focus is so much on, is it an ID or not? That's what really matters in this case. The commission gave a presentation the other day, and I was part of a panel that was part of it. And something I mentioned the other day, and I'm going to say again, there's so much focus on, is this an identification? And this was said multiple times in some of our meetings. What matters to Webster is whether or not that's his print or not. Like, that's what should matter. Well, I hate to say it, but that is not the only thing that matters.
Right.
Defense has many different avenues that they can go down, and it's rare that the thing that they're actually challenging is the ID. I mean, you and I have talked about, like, in all the cases that we know of, I can only think of, like, one or maybe two cases where you had a fingerprint analyst for one side say it's an ID, the defense expert comes in and says it's an exclusion, and then you have a miscarriage of justice. almost never happens. The Dandridge case is, I think, one of the ones that comes to mind.
Right.
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 That is not the only way defense can challenge. It is not, in fact, the most common way that defense can challenge. What defense can challenge is you didn't lay your foundation. You didn't allow for proper cross-examination because you didn't demonstrate the basis of your conclusions. You didn't document this and this. You hid some things from us. We didn't have access to this. We didn't know that existed. Those are all things that get cases turned over, not competing conclusions between examiners. So this obsession, and that's what I'm calling it, obsession with identification, that's the most important thing in this case. It's not. And if defense can make a good argument that you didn't do blind verifications, you didn't document prior to looking at the known, there could be potential bias, you might have been exposed to CODIS. Like, these are all things that they're going to talk about, whether or not they're true or not. Definitely going to focus on that and say, we didn't get a fair trial, which is due process. And if we didn't get a fair trial, then we have a right to a new trial. And that is how cases get overturned.
I think one of the simpler ways to describe this is if it's just the ID, right? If that's the only thing that matters, whether the ID was right, why do we bother with a chain of custody? Why is that important? Well, it's clearly important because we spend a whole hell of a lot of time dealing with it and tracking it and everything that comes along with chain of custody. So it's clearly more than just that final conclusion. Anyway, that's an excellent point. All right, so Glenn, in the last episode, you know, I made mention of this poll that the latent print was on, and and you called me out for using the word latent, and I'm like I said, still using it, that it wasn't necessarily technically latent in the hidden sense of that word, but was, you know, the matrix was appeared to be blood or was potentially blood. Was that ever officially tested and confirmed to be blood? What's the story with blood versus not blood on that pipe?
Well, that is a fascinating question. And boy, one of our upcoming episodes, Eric, we're going to have to talk about a case that I just testified in last week where question of blood was a huge issue. And so I'm very excited to talk about that because it's going to tie in very nicely with this episode as well.
Sure.
So now I'm going off my recollection. One of the issues in the case was, right, they had, I'm trying to remember if they had done pheno. I don't think they did pheno at the scene. I want to say they did like benzidine at the crime scene, which is a presumptive positive. For some reason, that's what's coming to mind. But they did my recollection was a presumptive positive for the possible presence of blood, which then allowed them to apply the amino black, which got a color reaction. Amino black is not blood specific, it's protein specific. And anybody that has ever worked with amino, and I have definitely done these tests, I can tell you that you will get a reaction, the amino black, like you will get it starting to turn blackish purple. If it is blood, semen, saliva, has urine in it, Worcestershire sauce, some ketchup, depending if it has anchovy or not in it, and anything else that has protein or amino acids in it, you can get a reaction. So to think that just because you get a reaction with amino black, it's definitely blood, disavow yourself of that view. So they did get a reaction, possibly contained some blood and or other bodily fluids, we don't know, and was near where this sex worker would purportedly have her sex acts in this alley. So easily could have been in this area. And at testimony, there was some issue that was brought up about the testimony. And there was I think this is one of the things that came up in the complaint, was that the fingerprint examiner sort of overextended themselves and called it blood.
Yeah, I have it here. Said, referred to it as the bloody print on direct examination, but conceded on cross that she could not say for certain that it was blood.
Yeah, right. And that's one of those things where, you know, I get it. You're on the stand. In your head, it's blood. You think it's blood. It looks like blood. Everything about it seems like blood. It slips out. You say bloody print because everyone else is calling it a bloody print.
Right.
This will be a huge part of our upcoming episode about this case, because this was a huge issue in this case. I just testified in last week. It was a major, major issue. We're going to bring in maybe some other people to talk about that case too. But yeah, I think it's very important for examiners to either call it apparent blood or My presumption is it's blood, but I don't know that it's blood. And ultimately, you asked if it was confirmed as blood. And at the time, I don't think it ever was, Eric. My understanding was they had a presumptive test, the amidal black, and then they got DNA from it, is my recollection. And it was the victim's blood. That was my recollection, was victim's blood. At some point later, and this was after he was convicted, I think defense had it sent out for independent testing to confirm that it was blood. And my recollection is it did not come back as blood, confirmed as blood. Doesn't mean it's not blood, just not confirmed. Right. We'll talk about this in the upcoming episode. There's only, surprisingly, there's only a couple of ways to confirm that something is blood. One of them nobody practically uses today. One of them is an instrument that nobody has. And there's really like only one test that exists that came about in 2000, I want to say like 9 or 10, maybe, started becoming standard practice, called Hematrace. And we'll talk about that in an upcoming episode. So My recollection is it was not confirmed as blood. And when they did send it out for confirmatory testing, it was not confirmed as blood. But it doesn't mean it wasn't blood, just they couldn't confirm that it was blood. Make sense?
Yeah. Yep. So, you know, kind of summarizing a bit here about this examination, right? It's different examiners who've looked at it at different times have come to different conclusions. It is a apparent bloody print, or at least, you know, left in a liquid visible matrix that, you know, we all know kind of those are not the easiest, not necessarily the easiest prints to compare. Right. It's on a curved surface, something metal with all the texture and complexities that come with that type of surface.
A galvanized pipe, which can be also tricky.
Exactly. There were DNA results that may or may not have been known to some people in this case. And being its location, the possibility of the matrix being blood, it's by its nature highly probative. It's the only ID to this guy in the case. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And has just through all of those things becomes the almost single linchpin of the entire prosecution.
Sure.
Put this in the complex category.
Yep.
Is that, I hope everyone out there listening agrees that that's fair.
Well,
that,
not everybody does, from what I've heard. Some have said with today's technology and with all, you know, Photoshop enhancements and all the images available and 60 some features, it's no longer complex.
I mean, heck, one or two of these things puts it. Is there anything we missed out? Is there anything that could make a print complex that's not included in this case? I think it's like all the boxes, right? Oh, I forgot. No cores or deltas. That's, you know, it's one of my favorites, obviously. If I'm remembering correctly,
it spans the hypothenar. Like, that's right. The major portion, but it does go up into the interdigital. And I don't actually think it's continuous. This is another interesting thing. It might actually like have
multiple pieces.
Mm-hmm. Because I've seen at least one examiner mark up 4 different regions of the impression, but I don't know that they're continuous in any way. There seems to be kind of a spatial gap, but this is another issue of whether or not it's one continuous print or multiple sections. And can you count from one section to another? Do you need to count from one section to another? Can you invoke simultaneity? When you really get into it, it is a very complex mark.
Yeah. It's got a messy major crease, the top crease. I guess you can see the delta, maybe. It might be obscured by noise and distortion, but it's at least, you can tell-ish about where it is.
Yeah, and you can tell it's a left palm hypothenar, which is another thing.
The D delta underneath the little finger of the interdigital area. All right, so, you know, we kind of went into a whole area here of your involvement and kind of all, a bunch of the things that you had seen as you were working on this case, assisting the commission. So going back to more of our timeline thing here, after Houston goes through, pulls all of those images out of the system, and you get a copy, they're also sent back to Houston for another recomparison. And to, you know, two more examiners there, original or a primary and verifier.
Examiners, not ones that looked at it the first time. So
that's why I wanted to confirm, is this is a different pair of examiners from the first pair that Henry had been working with.
Yes, that was mandatory.
And I can only presume that at this point, they're presented this case in a blind manner where they're not aware that it's this big case that's going on. I can only assume that folks within Houston kind of know that something's up with the case.
I'm not even sure that they were aware of that. I mean, there were a couple of people, tech leads and supervisors, aware of what was going on, but I don't know that the rank and file were aware of what going on. Yeah, they were given the L1, the mark, all the photographs available, and then they were also given three exemplars. They were given the two with the DNA hits and then another third person, which was exactly what Henry had given the first examiners when he did it the first time. So the same three exemplars in the case. But now, using the better, improved, high-quality digital scans and not the photocopy from the court record.
Right. So I love this part. With all now the best versions available that everyone that has so far made an ID had used, you know, the clearest versions, we're going to presume the both sets of palm prints from the suspect.
You're talking about 2001 and the 2003 set?
Yeah.
No.
No?
Just the 2001 set. Why give two sets from one person and one set from the other? Why not just give the best exemplar available for
one? But it's the best one. Okay. It's the good one that is sent to them. Okay.
Yes.
And the primary examiner that looks at all this now says inconclusive. Now, hands it off to the verifier. Verifier finds some correspondence, decides that it should be an ID. They have a consultation documented according to HFSC policy, and they settle on identification as the most appropriate conclusion for the comparison. But again, we have this variation you described, right? Depending on the images that you get, the features that you select, and you know, the methods that are used during the examination, it's possible for different examiners to reach different conclusions.
Right. If they didn't do it blind and you would just did an open verification, the one examiner would have been like, oh, yeah, okay. Well, you know, they would have been able to communicate with each other, not have it done blind, but they did it blind. So they independently wrote down their answers, then compared them, and they were different. If it was more of an open, dynamic process, not necessarily would have happened that way. Or, actually, now that I'm saying it out loud, how do we know that if you had given inconclusive to the second examiner, the verifier, what if they would have been influenced by the inconclusive decision? What if they then would have gone, well, it's probably not here. They don't see. We don't know. The point being is the method matters. The data matter. The images matter. That is the conclusion from this case.
I think it's very interesting that it's almost as if this now last set of comparisons done on it confirmed both the RSNA conclusion and the Henry group conclusion.
Exactly.
They confirmed it's an ID and not reproducible.
Yeah. I think that's actually a brilliant way of looking at it, Eric. Yes. Again, some will say, but what the answer here? Well, without ground truth, which we don't have ground truth, what this has demonstrated was exactly the data, the images, and the method.
If you're going to ask the question to this last group, should the conclusion be an identification? I think they clearly said yes.
Yes.
And if you're going to ask the group, is every good examiner going to always agree with that conclusion? I think they've revealed the answer is going to be no.
Yeah.
And I don't find that terribly surprising, right?
It because it's not based on the literature and the research. It's not.
I mean, think about it, people, right? How often do you have disagreements over sufficiency for a conclusion in your lab, right? It happens. Why this should not be a surprising thing that a latent of this complexity can be identified and also can produce different results from different examiners.
And that is what defense wanted. That's what they wanted and felt should have been expressed to jurors, was that this was not an easy one. It's not a straightforward one. Requires XYZ to get there. Maybe, you know, XYZ methods, XYZ processes, maybe digital enhancement, Photoshop, whatever. Defense wanted and felt that should have been communicated to jurors, that this was not something that every examiner is going to obviously all agree on instantly, just because, yes, multiple contractors did, but let's take a look at the methods that they use and their documentation, And this is all defense is trying to say is none of these things came out that allow us to actually highlight weaknesses in the evidence, because it's not that straightforward.
And you can't just say, oh, no, the jury doesn't need to know all that stuff. They just need to know it's an ID.
That was being said many, many times. And that's exactly what defense's point is. No.
That's not your call, right? The defense gets to give that information to the jury, and then the jury gets to decide whether that's important. The jury might decide, that's irrelevant. They said ID. Okay, that's what we need to, that's what we're going to go with, and we're going to convict the guy. Or the jury could decide, no, this is all really important. Wait, there's a 2001, a 2010, and a 2020 inconclusive, and then, you know, there's a 2013 ID and a kind of 2022 half ID that turned into a full ID. Any other evidence? No? Okay, we're not going to convict him. Like, that's up to the jury to decide which of those pieces need to fit together to form their, you know, their conclusion in the jury room.
Yes, and what this strikes me is part of our culture, and I think we're going to end up talking about in another episode in this other case I've been referring to, is this fear that examiners have of discussing limitations on the stand, that they don't want to talk about limitations in the evidence because it exposes or opens up difficult questions. And it's this fear that comes from being on the stand as opposed to being a neutral advocate for the evidence, talking about the strength and limitations. Examiners are very hesitant to talk about these kinds of limitations. And I, again, when we get this next episode, it might be a major thing that might have possibly contributed to a very interesting outcome in this case. So
yeah, I know it's hard, but man, you got to really try to not care.
Yeah.
Right?
You can't be an advocate trying to convict someone because you believe that it's an ID, so they must have done it.
I mean, care about being professional, care about presenting your findings, you know, the facts of the case, your conclusions in a understandable manner, but that is going to sometimes come with limitations, and discuss those too. And if the jury decides to that in the totality of the evidence, which you don't have, they have, is that it's not enough for a conviction, you can't care. You really can't. I know it's not that easy, but it's an important part of what we do.
So, you know, in this case, in the Webster case, and like we were just talking about, that's like general stuff. But in the Webster case, what's interesting is the examiner testified in the case. Like she wasn't asked these questions necessarily. So, you know, one of the things is she have any obligation to share all these? She wasn't asked it. She didn't document it. So I don't think she was hiding anything in the Webster case. This is where I depart from what happened in Webster versus my duty in as the subject matter expert. What about by today's standards of documentation and what OSAC is requiring? Like, what about these kinds of things that we require today? Well, that's a very different story. If we reevaluate Webster under today's standard, like we're looking at like what SwigFast required post 2010, which we're going to talk about here in a moment, and what OSAC is saying in their best practice recommendations, well, then these things actually are an obligation of the examiner to not only document them, but if asked, talk about them. And I'm sure defense would have talked about them in this case, but they weren't documented in the case. So it wasn't like they were hiding anything. There was no requirement to document them back then.
Right. But I mean, it seems clear that, like, even with the blood thing, right? The project manager, when testifying on cross, was asked about, hey, was there any confirmation test on blood? Didn't double down and say, of course it's blood. Look at it. It looks like blood.
Right.
You know, she rightfully so said that, you know, she did not have anything that could prove that it was blood. So completely agree. I don't think there's necessarily anything wrong with the answer she gave to the questions in the testimony, Director Cross, but it's that the defense didn't have the chance to ask questions based on a full documentation of what occurred.
And that is my view, because at least at that time, there was a document in 2010, updated in 2012 and 2013, which definitely would have been the time period of this case. Like, that's when the work was being done.
Right.
And that was both the Documentation for latent print examinations, which I remember Alice having a huge influence on writing that document. And so that document and then the document number 10, standard for friction ridge examinations and the resulting conclusions.
Yep.
These documents together, both were available, 2010, that said, if you have a complex latent print, and here, by the way, here's a chart for how to document complexity, which you must document complexity. And if you have a complex print, then you need to document it this way. And these are the things you need to do. One of the things that I told the commission was that wasn't done in this case. And that standard did exist at the time. Not they chose to follow it or, you know, they didn't feel it was enforceable or whatever. It doesn't matter. I would even accept the argument. Man, look, we've got thousands of cases to work through. And this is like an unprecedented event. We just don't really have the time or resources to document to that level. I would almost even understand that. As long as it was followed up with, you know, looking back, we could have done better, or maybe we should have done things a little differently. That never really came. So I think I was kind of left with, well, and at least the commission saw, hey, this is why these recommendations are important going forward, because this case clearly would have benefited. And Webster, his defense, clearly would have benefited from following the standards that were available at the time, and certainly by following today's standards. These things would have been available, and a proper cross-examination of this specific print could have been given in the Webster case. That's what it comes down to, the fairness and due process. One other thing that the commission wanted to talk about was they were surprised when they got the Houston Forensic Science Report, the one that basically had the inconclusive, followed by the ID, conflict resolution, report the identification. What they were surprised about was that the report said identification. That's all it said was identification. I think there might have been something about like there was, maybe there was like a tick box or something that was tick saying that there was conflict resolution. But when they just read the report, it was not clear to them that that's what had happened. They're like, well, they ID'd it. And then when I got all the data and all the notes and all the background, I went, hold up, guys, you're going to love this. And then I explained to them, and they're like, why is that not in the report? Why did that? And I said, well, they're not required to report that. They reported the ultimate conclusion, which is the result of the ACE and the V. That's their conclusion. So the commission, which of course has a number of lawyers are on it, and their view was, well, hold on. There should be some indicator in these reports. And then we talked about, well, yes, new OSAC standards clearly say for reporting practices, these kinds of difference of opinion should be disclosed in the report. I know attorneys that believe certainly that as part of disclosure, the government has a mandatory obligation to disclose those things, not wait to be asked on discovery, but a mandatory obligation to disclose differences of opinions. I know a number of attorneys and legal scholars that would fully agree with that. For whatever reason, our field has generally backed off and said, no, as long as it has been recorded, it's in the notes, it's in the data, you just got to find it and know what you're looking for and know where to look for it, but it's not in the report. And the commission had very strong views on this, and I tend to agree with them because I've been putting differences of opinions in my report now for 6 years. And I haven't had any issues. Like, I've had zero issues with doing it. In fact, it makes testimony easy because I've already disclosed it. They'll ask about it. I'm not hiding it. It's very clear. It's not been an issue. But right. It's a fear that examiners have of, well, if we put it in the report, they're going to know. They're going to know that we didn't agree. That means it must have been a difficult comparison. Yeah, that's exactly the point.
Yeah. It's not something that we can just opt out of because we don't like it. We operate in the criminal justice system. We don't make the rules for that system. We have to follow the rules for that system.
Yeah.
And it's clear that the quote-unquote minority report, even if it's not a full disagreement, if it's just a change of opinion initially to final, it's to be there.
Yeah. Lynn Garcia of the commission said, I would be fine with like a footnote at the bottom that said this conclusion is a result of a disagreement between examiners. Please see pages, blah, 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 of the notes, or go to this website or call this number for additional information regarding, as long as there was an indicator of,
sure,
hey, by the way, this conclusion, it's not as straightforward as you might think. And that to me is pretty reasonable.
So I think we mentioned it last time as well. One of the reasons that we didn't really go into all of this detail earlier in the year or even last year after the conference is because, you know, we felt it important that this report be finalized and public so that, you know, we could talk about it in its totality. That includes all of the recommendations that we're going to get into next, right? We didn't want to jump the gun and go into a whole bunch of detail on something that hadn't even been published yet.
And get something completely wrong, which now I'm going to call out somebody. There was a LinkedIn article a couple of weeks before the commission's report came out. And this article personally attacked me and Henry Swafford and a number of other people, RSNA, and it went all over the map. And it was so offensive to read because this person didn't know jack about this actual case, didn't know anything about this case, just what he had read and had never read the report, not involved at all. And there are two things that he spent a lot of time talking about the ethical investigation and said that Glenn Langenberg should never have been part of the ethical investigation of Ron Smith and Associates because he teaches for them. It was not an ethical investigation. If I had been asked to do an ethical investigation, I would have recused myself from that process. I'm not interested in an ethical investigation. That's not something I would have involved myself. And I would almost agree because I was working for RSNA. That would seem like a conflict of interest. But because I was assessing what was done in a case, I was looking at technical documents and talking about standards at the time, I actually felt I was very qualified for this. So for this examiner to say these things on LinkedIn and CLPEX, this examiner is just really a wackadoo. And that's all I can say. And that's all I'm going to say. I'm not even going to give him the pleasure of naming him. And it was just so off base. He talked about like models and all like Henry's like motivations and said all these things that had nothing to do with the report. This examiner is just a wackadoo. So that's my shot across the bow.
So the people with the popcorn buckets finally got something to watch there, huh? Okay.
Yeah. What an idiot.
All right. So let's hit some of the highlights here in the recommendations. The first one, I'm actually kind of glad they put this one first because it definitely is at the heart of everything that went on in this case over the entirety of the, you know, the years that comparisons were done. But it's use the best images, right? So that whether that's which version of the exemplars you're looking at or the resolution of the photographs or which parts are in focus or not in focus, use the best images.
And I'm going to add to that because, you know, one of my problems was I don't know what images people used in the case unless they wrote something on an image. So there were never a set of notes that said I used image 001, 002, 0010. That was actually in the Houston Forensic Science record. So I could clearly see what images they used that was not in the contractor. And that was a big problem because contractors kept saying, well, they would have used all the images. I don't know that. They might have had access to all the images, but I don't know that they used them all. How do I know that? How do I know during a technical review they just didn't use the one image that the original examiner used? How do I know that? Unless they wrote down which images we used, I don't know that they actually looked at them. In fact, there's one examiner in the case I know that looked at all of them. Why? His initials are on every photograph. So I know he actually looked at every photograph because his initials are on them. I'm willing to accept that. But some of the other examiners, I don't know what images they used, so it's not recorded.
You can't just assume that someone looked at every image, especially like the verifier, right? They could absolutely have just looked at a single image. Yep, I agree with that conclusion and write it down, document the verification and be done with it. Unless there is something else specifying what they looked at.
Why would you not want to record which images you looked at in a massive case with lots of images where the images truly matter? Why would you not want to do
that? And they're so different from each other.
Yes. Yeah.
All right. So the next recommendations are regarding analysis. I mean, I think it's pretty straightforward stuff and reasonable and stuff that we already do. I've been doing even back when I was in Arizona. We as in you and I. But that's document the latent before you do the comparison. Document the quality of the features that you are using during the analysis. Document and report out the difficulty and complexity of the impressions. And then use additional quality control methods for difficult or complex latent prints.
Seems very fair and reasonable to me.
And hopefully if you're at an agency where some of these steps are not in your, you know, not set up as a process or in your manuals or protocols that you can choose to do additional documentation above what your coworkers are doing. And that's what I did when I was still with Arizona, decided, you know what, I'm going to do for every latent print that I compare, a full-on analysis using Gyro, regardless of what conclusion I end up with on this latent print. Didn't really make a huge impact in my casework. I had a whole lot more documentation, and I think that benefited my work. So hopefully you're in a position to do that, or you're already working somewhere where like they require all this anyway, because it's our best practices, it's in our standards, and this is the direction that our field is heading. So the only question that remains is, what is the most effective and efficient way to do all these things? That we can work together to figure out, but whether or not to do them, that ship is long sailed. Again, it's not even show me the research that shows that we need to do all these things. Not the point, right? The point is not to improve the accuracy by implementing these methods. That may happen. It may become more accurate because these methods are being followed, but that's not the point. The point is, we do this to meet the rules of the criminal justice system that we operate in.
Well said.
Okay. Comparison recommendations. I would summarize them all down to short little bursts, so I'll just kind of try to run through them. Comparison recommendations. This is kind of the biggest chunk. It's choose an exemplar that's as complete as possible when you're doing your comparison. Compare the features that you documented in the analysis. Look for both correspondence and non-correspondence when you do your side-by-side. Don't just look for similarities. Document the correspondence that you find. Document the difference between features that you had seen during analysis and features that you're only now seeing in comparison, you know, the ones that you found because you worked from the knowns backwards. Document the complexity of the comparison. When you move on to evaluation, evaluate both similarities and differences to formulate your conclusion. If you change the features that are marked up, make sure that that's documented, the orange features in the Gyro system. And then make sure you document specifically which latents and which images and which exemplars that you compared. I mean, some of these recommendations are just like latent prints 101, right? Looking for both correspondence and non-correspondence. I mean, yeah. Again, not to say that someone didn't do this in the case, but I appreciate the commission being thorough in making sure that they're very clear. Let's make sure that we're doing all these things and documenting these things to provide a reliable and, you know, robust case record.
Yes. And some of those things were done and some of them weren't. And it was one of the things I noted when I was looking at the corresponding features that were marked up basically post-identification. So let's mark up the matching features. You never saw anywhere like any false minutia because, of course, they were marked up with a known impression. Why would you mark false minutia that don't exist unless you did an analysis of the latent print first? And that was one of those, again, indicators of, well, how can you address the differences? There's zero documentation of differences observed because there are clearly no differences in this when you're working from the known. And so you don't have a sense of what differences did the examiner actually observe here. You're only seeing the similarities because that's what's documented. And it's those little things that show a more robust, a more rigorous, and more what I think of as, of course, scientific approach, as opposed to we just need to do enough to show the ID and let's move on. And that's, as you pointed out, that's not the purpose of this. The purpose is not about, the focus shouldn't just be on, it shouldn't just be on getting it right. It should be this, all these other things, getting it right in a transparent manner.
Right. All right. So the next set is on the conclusions. The recommendations are to use the expanded scale of conclusions beyond just the three. Mm-hmm. Abandon use of the non-identification term.
I will say everybody agreed on that. That was across the board. Everybody.
Good.
Everybody said, yeah. I mean, there's a reason why we've done away with this. Yes. If you're going to exclude, let's.
We have come a long way over the past 12 years.
Agreed.
About that non-ident term. And then adopt criteria for all conclusions. So that examiners know when they're supposed to use each one. And appropriate QA measures to reduce errors. Again, we've talked quite a bit about the expanded scale in the past. We're probably going to continue talking about it a whole bunch in the future. So I don't want to go into a whole bunch of detail on the benefits that come with that expanded scale right now, especially how long with it. Our two episodes have gone on so far. but they clearly see a benefit from using this type of reporting scale, this reporting scheme. And I think that's going to continue to grow, right? Where you're going to see it become much clearer as the criminal justice system, right? The lawyers, the judges start to realize, wait a minute, why is this group doing things different than everybody else? Hey guys, get it together and give us your conclusions in the same way that everybody else gives their conclusions. And because it fits in better with this entire system that we have here and all the evidence that's coming into the court.
Two things on that. One, you know, I never said this before, but if you read some of these conclusions, there might be some confusion like, well, this is Glenn like promoting his agenda. This is Glenn, you know, trying to get all these academic things and OSAC things out there. I didn't write this report. I mean, I had some say in the report. I had some thoughts, and especially the technical aspects of the report. I got to present some language, but ultimately what went in that report, I didn't write it. And I didn't actually write these recommendations. So it amazed me when I read this list. I went, oh yeah, these are great. I would recommend all of these. Fantastic. Some of those I thought were a little overkill, like you pointed out. But at the end of the day, I agreed with them all. I didn't write any of them. So I did want to point that this is coming from the commission, made up by a number of lawyers, and they're saying, yeah, you know, this expanded conclusion scale might have some merit.
So just then here we kind of get into some of the miscellaneous ones towards the end of the list recommendations. You know, document consultations and have a policy that distinguishes between consultation and discussion. Ensure that there's training in blood prints or prints with a possible blood matrix, curved textured surfaces. You make sure these kinds of samples are in proficiency tests, competency tests. Don't overstate the presumptive testing for blood. I think this comes up because it was a point on cross, and I think the examiner there handled it properly on cross, but the commission seems to want to emphasize we have to be careful here, especially in this type of case where so much does hinge on whether or not it's blood.
Mm-hmm. That might have been my only contribution as I'm listening to these. That might be the only thing I said, hey, we should add something about blood prints. That might be the one that I added, because I do find that a number of examiners I run across seem to think that blood prints really aren't that different from regular latent prints. And, you know, I teach a whole webinar on how they're so very different and can have very different characteristics and properties and a number of things about them. And I have witnessed, I mean, not just, I witnessed examiners testifying in the courtroom. Well, blood prints are basically the same. I mean, they can be more complex, but, you know, not necessarily, but, you know, I don't treat them any differently. You should.
Right.
You really should. And you should potentially treat them as very complex latent prints because of potential distortions in blood prints.
All right. So some of the other ones, where resources permit, become accredited. And this is for labs and for examiners participate in the licensure program. I like the way that they handled this in the webinar last week, especially the attorneys. You know, they acknowledge that in the short term, not every agency with latent print examiners or providing forensic services has the resources to become accredited tomorrow.
Right.
I think they'd push for more grant funding to get more agencies to that point, to provide the resources for agencies to go through that exercise. But they don't want to blow up the whole system because it's not perfect. They recognize that there's some part of this that's a journey towards better work, better results, better forensic service providers. And part of that journey, I think you can see with this commission is, you know, they have this licensing program for examiners in the state. And, you know, it started off with this exception for latent print examiners where they didn't have to go through the whole licensing. You did if you were in a different forensic field, but not for latent print examiners. And they've gone now to the next step of opening it up so that if you want to, as a latent print examiner, you can become licensed through the state to do that work. And I hope they continue on to that next step of, okay, let's get latent prints on with everybody else of being licensed with the state to do this work. So you're not just someone that's part-time at it in addition to the other 20 things you're doing for the county you work for. So it's sometimes crazy to me that Texas is somehow leading the way, setting the example for so many other states and how to set up something like this to improve forensic work in their state. But absolutely kudos to them for doing it.
100%. Yes. Hats off and so much respect for them leading that pathway.
Disclosure. Ensure that the entire record is obtained during discovery. Oh, man. this is one of those things where an ounce of prevention, right? The getting on top of it so that something is, a case is easy to disclose in advance so that when someone asks for it, it's just boop, all right, click there. It's there it is. Here's all of it. It is so important because it's this becomes so much work if you're trying to do it after the fact. And when people think about the effort involved in disclosure, I think they think about it from this after the fact mindset. But if you can set it up ahead of time to be easy, I mean, it just becomes something you don't really have to think about because it's all just handled in your policies as the case is being worked in the first place.
And there are technologies today that can assist with that as well, that can do some of these things or at least assist in store and disseminate some of this information to make it easier.
Yeah, absolutely. It's going to be a lot of work setting that all up and getting everything, all the bugs worked out. But once it's set up, it just runs and it makes things much smoother and provides, you know, better service to the...
Yes.
And then what I really liked here was this recommendations to OSAC, right? Specifically to the OSAC Friction Ridge Subcommittee to consider alternatives to the individualization terminology. I was a little kind of miffed with that one because we don't have individualization terminology, but I think I understand the spirit of that recommendation, as if not the precise wording for it. Consider other factors for complexity beyond just the number of features, and then some recommendations for, you know, just the federal government overall, assist agencies with funding for blind proficiency test programs, development of tools, software, methods, techniques to reduce variance in the feature selection process. And that, back again, the Friction Ridge Subcommittee should consider adding more specifics to the research needs regarding palm prints.
Yeah, they were really good recommendations.
I really struggle to find a recommendation I would disagree with or haven't already done or did back in Arizona, or there's always room for improvement. So some of these things I think could be done better in different agencies, and other agencies have set the bar as, hey, that's definitely the way to do it. You should aim for that. But these are all fantastic recommendations of where our field should be heading. And for the almost the entire thing is already in the best practice docs and standards docs that are either complete or working their way through the system in OSAC and ASB.
That's kind of what their view was. After they read those documents, they went, these all make sense. Why isn't everyone doing them? Well, it takes more time. It takes a lot more time to do some of these, and these are still relatively new, and they're certainly more than what SwigFast was recommending. So yes, I agree that there are some very reasonable things in these documents, and some of it requires more than some agencies are currently doing. But yeah, that was their view.
I don't mean to make it sound like all of these things are easy to do. There, some of these are difficult. And I hope that the effort in our community is focused on how can we accomplish these things in the most efficient and effective manner possible. Move beyond arguing whether or not to do these things. How can we do these things the easy way? That's what I really want to get us to focus on. Because it's going to take a lot of smart people with a lot of good ideas to get us to that point. And I can picture it 20 years from now when someone just signed off on casework. So they've gone through all the training and they look back in history and they see this report with all these recommendations and going, why did anyone have to bother to write this down, right? This, you know, not only is this obvious and this is how I was trained and how I'm working now in my casework, but it's so easy, right? Why would you not do any of this?
Yeah, I hope so too, Eric.
All right. Well, we recorded longer than I thought we were going to tonight, but I think it's just the buildup of so many months of not talking about it, finally all just coming out in one big bleh.
I agree. And it's an important case that has lots of different elements. We want to be fair about it and try to capture those things. I didn't want to be accused of, well, you left this out and you didn't talk about this, or, yeah, you know, I tried to cover them. There's frankly a lot we left out, and really, I mean, yeah. But I think we focus on what I feel are the important parts of this case.
And just to put a bow on kind of my thoughts on this, for the examiners with RSNA and Houston Forensic Science Center that reached those identification conclusions, I think they reached a correct and supportable conclusion. For the affidavit that Henry wrote up based on the examiners that he was in contact with, it said that the conclusions for this latent print were not reproducible. Also think that's right. I think the series of conclusions that came out, I think that's also a supportable statement to make. So hopefully we can just put that part behind us and then focus on these recommendations to make things better.
That's exactly where I'm at. This case is now behind me, and I look forward to helping agencies or examiners work through these recommendations and find ways to implement them in their casework. So as we wrap up here, I have a couple of classes coming up. I've got a courtroom testimony class in Irvine, California. That's May 6th through May 8th. I also have an HV class where we talk about documentation and all these kinds of standards and how to implement them. That is also in the Los Angeles area. That is August 19th through the 23rd. I'll be teaching an HV class in England, also Brazil, and also Switzerland this year. If you're interested in any of these classes, including some of the international ones, feel free to reach out to me. Email me, Glenn@EliteForensicServices, or go to either ronsmithandassociates.com for those classes or for webinars, which are at evolveforensics.com.
I'll be at the California Division Conference, the Pacific Northwest Division Conference, the Texas Division Conference, the big IAI in Reno, Nevada. So if at all possible, come to one or more than one of these conferences, and I'll see you there. But hopefully I see you at one or more of these conferences around the country. If you have any questions about this case or anything that we talk about, Eric@RayForensics.com or Glenn@EliteForensicServices.com. The opinions expressed on the show are those of the speaker, not necessarily anyone that they work for. And with that, talk to you guys next time.
Bye, everybody. Have a great week.